From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Paul Simon. We'll talk about the different phases of his music, beginning with his teenage years when he recorded with Art Garfunkel under the name of Tom and Jerry. And we'll listen to music from Paul Simon's new CD, You're the One. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the controversial journal of Romanian writer Mihail Sebastian, an account of the Nazification of Europe during the years 1935 to 44. It's just been published in English for the first time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The presidential candidates are waiting for word from the United States Supreme Court. The court could rule at any time after hearing 90 minutes of arguments today concerning whether to allow the recounting of presidential votes in Florida. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports the questions from the justices can be as revealing as the answers.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's considered a possible swing vote, asked why the Supreme Court should be involved in this case at all.
Can you begin by telling us our federal jurisdiction? Where's the federal question here?
Bush lawyer Ted Olson answered that Florida's Supreme Court violated federal law by changing the rules after the election. He also contended that a recount of some votes endangers equal voting rights. When his turn came, Gore lawyer David Boies argued that Florida's courts have the authority to count votes from this contested election. That drew a sharp question from Justice Antonin Scalia. The conservative jurist asked why Florida officials bothered to count votes and recount votes and certify the election if a court was only going to do it again. Boies argued that he doesn't want to start over the whole process. He says he wants a judge only to examine disputed ballots. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Florida Supreme Court has just issued a response to the U.S. Supreme Court explaining its decision to extend the deadline for hand recounts of presidential ballots. The state high court said it based that ruling on Florida law. The Florida justices decided to extend the deadline after Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris refused to accept amended election returns after November 14th. At that point, George W. Bush had a 930-vote lead. The Florida Supreme Court said today that it merely interpreted the state statute and did not form any new rules of state law. The city of Chicago and much of the Midwest is coping with a blizzard that's dumping more than a foot of snow. It's forcing scores of schools and businesses to close and hundreds of flight cancellations. David Shaper reports from Chicago Public Radio.
The snow was coming down for much of the day at a rate of an inch or two an hour. Chicago's Aviation Commissioner Thomas Walker says the snowstorm forced the cancellation of about 75% of Monday's flights into and out of the city's O'Hare and Midway airports.
We have a full complement of snow removal equipment operating, over 300 pieces at both O'Hare and Midway, to make sure that we're back in operation as soon as the snow has come through. However, we don't expect that to happen until tomorrow morning.
The flight cancellations in Chicago are having a ripple effect throughout the airline industry nationwide, forcing delays and cancellations across the country. When the snow finally tapers off, temperatures are expected to plummet and the winds will pick up, pushing the wind chill to 30 or 40 below zero. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
Stocks closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 13 points to close at 10,725. The Nasdaq gained 97 points. This is NPR. Committees of the Florida House and Senate have approved resolutions to name a slate of electors pledged to George W. Bush. The resolutions now go to the full chambers, both of which are controlled by Republicans. The House is scheduled to meet tomorrow and the Senate on Wednesday. The U.S. Department of Education has settled a multi-million dollar discrimination suit. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
In 1991, black employees at the U.S. Education Department filed a lawsuit alleging that administrators bypassed them for job promotions and did not seriously consider black applicants for key job openings at the department's huge headquarters in Washington, D.C. Although Education Department officials have argued they've done nothing wrong, the agency has agreed to pay $4 million to 1,100 current and former employees. As part of the agreement, 34 of those employees will be promoted, and a new job promotion policy will be put in place. The agency has also agreed to post job vacancies that are more explicit and clear, but the Education Department is not required to hire or promote people based on race. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Iraq says it will keep selling oil under the United Nations Oil for Food program for another 6 months. Iraqi leaders had balked at renewing the deal. They first insisted on the right to impose a surcharge on the oil, then argued that the Oil for Food program was just an excuse for the United States and Britain to maintain an economic embargo against Iraq. Last week, the UN approved a resolution that would allow Iraq to spend another 5% of the proceeds for humanitarian purposes. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Simon has a CD of new songs called You're the One, which unites different phases of his career, from folk music to world music. Last night, he mixed old and new songs at a concert in New York. We invited him to talk with us about his career, which dates back to when he was a teenager and recorded with Art Garfunkel under the name Tom and Jerry. After they recorded under their own names, as Simon and Garfunkel, they became one of the most popular folk-influenced groups of the 60s, recording such hits as Sounds of Silence, Homeward Bound, Mrs. Robinson, and Bridge Over Troubled Water. Let's start with the opening track from his new CD. This is called That's Where I Belong.
Somewhere in a burst of glory, sound becomes a song. I'm bound to tell a story. That's where I belong. When I see you smiling, when I hear you singing, lavender and roses, every ending a beginning. The way you turn and catch me with your eye, that's where I belong.
I asked Paul Simon about the early days in his career when he worked in the music business for a music publishing company.
It was just when I was coming out of college, and they offered to pay me, I think, $150 a week, which seemed like so much money that I really couldn't refuse it. But I was probably never more miserable than doing that. And my job was to go and take the songs that this huge publishing company owned and go around to record companies and to A&R men at record companies and see if any of their artists wanted to record The Peanut Vendor or... which I think was one of their songs or something like that. And I worked for them for, about 6 months maybe. And I never got one song placed. But I did give them a couple of my songs that I was writing because I felt so guilty about taking their...
Which songs?
Their check. Very early songs, I think, like Bleecker Street, maybe some songs that weren't even recorded. And then I got into an argument with them. And I said, look, you know, I quit. I'm out of here. I don't want to work here anymore. And I'm not giving you my new song. And see ya. And the song that I had just written was The Sound of Silence. And I said, well, I'll just publish this myself. And that's and from that point on, I've owned all of my songs. So that was a lucky argument that I had with this guy.
That's great. What year was it that you took back that song?
It was somewhere around 1963, because I left the country after Kennedy was assassinated. I was very upset about it, and I left and I went to live in England for a while. And it was somewhere around in there.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Sounds of Silence, because that's, if you had to choose a song that was like a good kind of prototype of young alienation, that would be it, you know? People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening. It just seems to be so much about this kind of youthful alienation. What do you think?
Yes, it's true, but I think about songs that it's not just what the words say, but it's what the melody says and what the sound says. My thinking is that if you don't have the right sound and you don't have the right melody, it really doesn't matter what you have to say. People don't hear it. They only are available to hear when the sound entrances and makes people open to the thought. And so really the key about the Sound of Silence, I think, is the simplicity of the melody and the words, which are really, in a sense, well, they're youthful alienation. It's a young lyric, but actually not bad for, you know, a 21-year-old, but, you know, not a sophisticated thought, and not a thought that I, you know, it was a thought that I gathered from somewhere, you know, probably from some, you know, college reading material or something, you know? It wasn't something that I was experiencing and on some deep, profound level. Nobody's listening to me. Nobody listens to anybody. It was a post-adolescent angst, but it had some level of truth to it, and it resonated with, it resonated with millions of people, as it turns out. But I think largely because it had this very simple and singable and memorable melody.
Well, why don't we hear it? And this is Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw.
That's Simon and Garfunkel. My guest is Paul Simon, and he has a new CD called You're the One. Continuing and talking about your early career in music, I think it was during that era when you were working for the publishing company that you also ended up cutting demos, and this was before there were Simon and Garfunkel hits. Were you doing demos for other singers of how songs should sound?
Yeah, I was doing demos for a long time. The publishing company job, that was only a few months.
Mm-hmm.
That was really an anomaly. But the demos was really how I learned to record, and how I learned about recording technique. Because I was in the studio several days a week. And for a while, I did a lot of demos with Carole King. And we worked as a team, because she could play drums and piano, and I could play guitar and bass. And we could sing the parts and make up background parts and do it pretty quickly. And what it was writers would have a song that they wanted some specific artist to sing, and they'd, you know, give you the song, and you'd try and make it a demo that would appeal to that artist.
So did you learn a lot about craft when you were doing all these demos? Well, not only what it took to make a good song, but then what it took to put a song across on record?
I learned how to record, how you got sounds on a record, and learned to be comfortable in a studio playing and to, get it relatively quickly in a couple of takes because there wasn't much time. They'd book studios by the hour. And you tried to do two or three songs in an hour because you got paid by the song. So I began to learn, what studios in around town had facilities that maybe I could use and who was good and what tricks or whatever information that you would amass by, doing the task over and over again, week after week. And I did that for a few years, like 2 or 3 years, maybe more. And all of that experience was very useful to me by the time I got up to recording the first album for Columbia, the Simon & Garfunkel first album.
My guest is Paul Simon. He has a CD of new songs called You're the One. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Simon. He has a new CD called You're the One. You grew up in Queens, which was then, I think, much more suburban than it is now. Did you grow up in a pretty middle-class neighborhood?
Yes. Yeah, attached houses.
How did you feel about the neighborhood? Did it feel connected to or isolated from the kind of music you really loved?
That music would be coming from...
the radio,
at that time,
right?
Probably coming from... certainly from radio. That's the first that I heard it. And if it was originating in New York, that'd be coming from Harlem. That'd be uptown. That would be where most of the doo-wop, the really good doo-wop groups were coming from.
Was that the first music that really struck you, was doo-wop?
Well, my first memory of being taken with a piece of music was... It was a summer day, and I was waiting for a Yankee game to come on. And I was listening to the show that preceded the Yankee game. And I was going to score the game, so I was filling out my scorecard, getting ready for the game to begin. And the show was a pop music show. And it was called, I think it was called Make Believe Ballroom. And the disc jockey said, here's a record that they've given to me. He said, this has to be one of the worst records I've ever heard. He said, if this record is a hit, I'll eat my hat. And he played a record called G by the Crows. And I thought, as I was filling out my lineup, that's the first thing I've heard on that show that I thought was decent. I couldn't stand all the rest of it. And it was an R&B record. So that's my first recollection. Then the next thing, of course, was that Alan Freed's show, which was called The Moondog Show, was played on WINS in New York. And what he played was sort of a mix of doo-wop and rhythm and blues, but it also had, in those early days, the Sun Record people, Presley, Perkins, Johnny Cash, and in a year or so later, the Everly Brothers. So there was a pretty wide variety of what was then called rock and roll. And I just thought it all belonged together. I never really differentiated.
So if the music seemed strange and kind of distant to you, did you feel like you could make that music too, or did it seem too far away?
It didn't seem distant. It seemed like I'd wanted to be with that music forever, but was just hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And soon after that I began to write. I wrote my first song. It was called The Girl For Me. And it was a doo-wop song, and it was sung around, and lots of little groups sang it in the neighborhood. It wasn't just our group. It sort of became famous in a couple of adjacent neighborhoods. In a way, it was like a hit. And then pretty soon after that, and I'm talking about age 14 now, but by age 15, I wrote a song with Artie called Hey School Girl, and we went into some studio and made a demo of it. For $5, you could make a recording if you recorded it directly onto acetate and didn't use the tape. $5. And we made that, and there was some guy waiting to use the studio after us who heard it, and he said, I have a record company. I'd like to put that record out. And he asked, to call our parents. And he did, and we made our first record, and it was a hit. I mean, it sold like 100,000 copies or something, and was in the top 5 or 10 in New York. And I think it got into the top 50 nationally. And that was the first record that we made.
Why don't we hear it? And this is Simon and Garfunkel, but recorded under the names of Tom and Jerry. Made in 1957, this is Hey School Girl.
Ooh-bop-a-loo-chi-ba, you're mine. Say, ooh-bop-a-loo-chi-ba, you're mine. Hey, schoolgirl in the second row. The teacher's looking over, so I gotta whisper way down low. You say, ooh-bop-a-loo-chi-ba, let's meet at the school after three. She said, hey, babe, there's one thing more. My school is over at 4:30.
That's Tom and Jerry, or Simon and Garfunkel, as they later became. Paul Simon is my guest. He has a new CD called You're the One. Very Everly Brothers-ish, don't you think?
Well, that's how we learned to sing.
Uh-huh.
We had two models, the Everly Brothers and Robert and Johnny.
Well, who were Robert and Johnny?
Well, Robert and Johnny had a song, a really pretty song. It was called You're Mine and We Belong Together. But of the two, the Everly Brothers were the more influential, and certainly in the writing at that point, with Hey School Girl, was more like an imitation of the Everlys.
Why did you use the names Tom and Jerry for this record?
We didn't. The record company gave it to us. If you think back to 1957, which you probably, I don't know if you can or you can't, because I don't know how old you are.
I can.
Okay. It was really impossible to use an ethnic name. You couldn't use those names that had any ethnicity. In fact, it was a daring move in 1964 when Columbia Records said, I don't think you guys should be called, I think you should go by your name. I think you should be called Simon and Garfunkel. When that first happened in 1964, there was a lot of, like, is that a law firm kind of jokes?
And a Catskills
so,
Act.
Exactly. And so that really what was going on. In 1957, that was unheard of, that anybody would be entering into pop music from that didn't have Anglo-Saxon name. The guy who owned the record company gave us the name Tom and Jerry after the cartoon characters.
Oh. So everyone, I think it's fair to say, everyone is self-conscious at the age of 15 or 16. You know, you're going through this really transitional phase. You're not really sure who you are yet. When you were that age, you were playing on bandstands. Did it make you any more or less self-conscious to be getting this really early notoriety?
Well, first of all, We started to sing together and, you know, in junior high school. We would sing at talent shows. And so we were sort of always, I don't know if famous is a word, famous in your school.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the guys who sing. That was unusual in and of itself. And, of course, the thing that was of making a record and hearing it on the radio wasn't a huge thrill. That's all we wanted. Oh, we just want to hear our song on the radio. And when it got on American Bandstand, well, that was just beyond what you could imagine, you know, that it would be voted on American Bandstand as the favorite record, and then you'd get an invitation to come all the way down to Philadelphia and ride on the train and go to a, you know, a new city that you didn't, never seen, and a big day excursion. It was a huge thrill. And then the first time that we appeared on the show, the other act that was on the same day with us was Jerry Lee Lewis. So we were completely, you know, blown away. It was just some incredible stroke of luck. And all of a sudden, instead of getting an allowance from your parents, you know, all of a sudden earned a couple of $1,000, which was, you know.
What'd you do with the money?
Well, I put the money in the bank, but what it did was I changed from a person who had to ask my parents for any money to somebody who, if I wanted to buy clothes, I bought the clothes that I wanted because I had my money. If I wanted to buy a car when when I got to that age, I had enough money and I bought a car. And it was a very early independence. Not that my parents weren't happy to, you know, to be typical parents and give me an allowance, but it was over. That was over. So in a way, I grew up pretty fast because I had earned this money.
Paul Simon will be back in the second half of the show. He has a new CD called You're the One. I'm Terry Grossin. This is Fresh Air.
Look at that, look at this. Drop a stone in the abyss. Then walk away and know that anything can happen. Just like that, just like this. Look at that, look at this. Give me a hug, give me a kiss. Hey, 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 and off to school we go. You might learn something, yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, a story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The first time I heard Peggy Sue, I was 12 years old. Russians up in rocket ships and the war was cold.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Paul Simon, and Maureen Corrigan reviews a controversial journal about the Nazification of Europe.
First time I smoked, guess what? Paranoid. First time I earned satisfaction, I was young and unemployed. Down the decades, every year, summer leaves and my birthday's here. And all my friends stand up and cheer and say, man, you're old, getting old. You're old, you're getting old. We celebrate the birth of Jesus on Christmas Day. And Buddha found Nirvana along the Lotus Way. About 1,500 years ago, messenger Muhammad spoke. And his wisdom like a river flowed through hills of gold. Wisdom is old. The Koran is old. The Bible is old. Greatest story ever told.
disagreements, work them out. The human race has walked the earth for 2.7 million.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Simon. Before we talk more, let's hear the title track from his new CD, You're the One.
May 12 angels guard you while you sleep. Maybe that's a waste of angels, I don't know. I'd do anything to keep you safe from the danger that surrounds us. Little by little, bit by bit, little bit by little bit, now you got it, that's it. What are you thinking? Things will go sour, take its temperature every hour, nervous when you own it, nervous when it's gone. What do you think has been going on for so long?
The early music that you really love was rhythm and blues and doo-wop. Then you must have really fallen in love with folk music as well, because, you know, your own music was certainly influenced by that. How did that phase of your life start, of really enjoying folk music?
The folk scene in Greenwich Village around Bleecker and McDougal was a real magnet for everybody, really. And we went down there and hung around, and We wanted to be in that. The rock and roll world at that point, it was in a real teen corporate phase, packaged kind of acts. And here was folk music, which sounded, sort of strange but familiar. And then the writing that went on, it was a more mature writing, you know, because of Bob Dylan's influence and Phil Oakes and Tom Paxton and Dave Van Ronk. And that world of folk singers were writing more serious songs.
Is that when you started to realize that you could write songs that were really different from the lyrics that you'd heard in doo-wop or rhythm and blues, lyrics that were more topical or more introspective?
Yes, that's right. The interesting thing about the rhythm and blues stuff, though, was that when I first listened, not this phase that I was rejecting, but the early stuff, which was very simple, really simple lyrics, you know, I'll always be true, I'll always love you, those kind of rhymes. What was understood by everybody was that there was a subtext that was real about, that was really about life, and that what was being sung was the simplest of rhymes, but underneath it was
a lot of deep feelings.
Gangs and sex and
right.
James Dean and some kind of, maybe people were smoking reefers or drinking. It wasn't so goody-goody. It was bad. But you couldn't say it in the songs, but everybody understood that it was a code. And, you know, skipping ahead decades, when I start to write the doo-wop material for the Cape Man and use the real raw language of what was going on in the street, that's really what I was saying, which was that the sound of it sounded innocent, but actually everybody understood what the culture really was. It was just a facade of innocence, but underneath it was, it was less innocent. The folk music, in some ways, actually was the opposite, because it sort of pretended it knew more than it did. It had a world weariness that really nobody was entitled to, considering that we were all just kids.
Oh, I know what you mean. Well, here's something I've wondered. You know, a lot of, like, your early records, the Simon and Garfunkel records, I think of those in particular, were listened to by, say, people in high school and college who were having their first experiences with people, you know, first kind of like love experiences, the first experiences drinking or smoking marijuana or maybe even tripping. And your records were being heard in this very kind of open and impressionable state. And I think music makes such a big impact on people who are young and who are going through all of this for the first time. Have you thought about that much, about the kind of special impact of your music on a people of a certain age?
I think about the fact that at certain ages, we really form our musical taste. So the sounds that you hear at a certain age really have a great impact upon you. And again, is what I said earlier, if the words also resonate with your life in some kind of something that feels emotionally true, then you're going to really leave a mark on people's lives and their memories, because those songs become associated with events that they're highly charged, because we're very open and emotional at those ages, and so everything that's happening is new and it's fantastic, and so. Part of the power of Simon and Garfunkel, and why the Simon and Garfunkel records still sell in the millions today, is because they occurred in those, you know, in those times, which actually were even hyper emotional compared to the decades that preceded it and followed it.
There's a demo that was released on a box set of Bridge Over Troubled Water, you doing the demo of it.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to play this because I think it's really interesting to hear you, you know, doing the demo version of it. And before we hear it, I'm wondering, is this in a higher key than the actual record is?
Well, I'm not sure what key it is or what key the record is. It's the key that I wrote it on the guitar, and it was too high, so I'm going into falsetto. Also, I'm not really doing anything other than sketching out a demo. So,
Right. But
I decided somewhere relatively early, I can't remember exactly when, relatively early, that that the song should be played with piano, like a gospel song. And I was listening to a lot of gospel music at that time, the Swan Silvertones and the Soul Stirrers and Dixie Hummingbirds. Those were the groups I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some idea about a gospel sound that I wanted, and there was a piano. So I knew that the song was going to change to piano, and my instinct was that Artie should sing it. So that's the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear your demo version of it. This is Paul Simon.
When you're weary, feeling sad, when peace is all you seek, I'll be there.
Talk more with Paul Simon after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here.
My guest is Paul Simon. He has a new CD called You're the One. You've done a lot of investigation of international music, particularly music of Africa, Latin America. When did you start getting the impulse to listen to music that was that far away from home? I mean, this was before Afropop became, you know, very popular. How were you first exposed to it, and why did you decide to get deeper into it?
I think I was first exposed to it with Alan Freed and what I said earlier. When you mix in into the same half hour something by Carl Perkins and The Moon Glows and Ruth Brown and Ray Charles and Johnny Cash, and you call it all rock and roll, and you say it's all the same because it's called rock and roll. What you're really talking about, or Fats Domino, what you're really talking about is music from Louisiana, which is heavily syncopated and influenced by Caribbean rhythms, which are really West African, and or the Everly's, or Carl Perkins, and that music is, in the Everly's case, that's like that's Appalachian influenced, and so that's coming from a Celtic tradition, and Frankie Lyman and the doo-wop groups, they're coming from a gospel quartet, which is also a mix of African and English, and so very early on, I was exposed to a lot of different cultures. Just nobody explained it that way. Plus, my father was a musician, and he played music from his era, which was probably the big band era. And he used to play, he often used to play at Roseland Ballroom in New York. And there was another band on that would play with him. And it was a Latin band, so I heard Latin music, too.
Tell me more about your father, about what he played, what kind of music.
He played, he played bass, and he was a leader of a band sometimes. He had a band that played, and sometimes he worked for other people, and he played all kinds of music, and it was a generation of musicians that prided themselves on the fact that they could play all kinds of music. And
did his band play for, like, bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like that?
Could do that. Mm-hmm. The band could play that, or it could play at a dance place like Roseland, mm-hmm. or he was on the Arthur Godfrey television show. He was in that band. He made some records. He was on some of the early rock and roll records. Somebody
really
call him up and book him, and he'd play. Really, it was a generation, as I said, that, you know, prided themselves on just put the music in front of me, and I can play it. It's whatever it is, there's a familiarity with it, if not a great expertise. So anyway, my background was, I was exposed to a lot of different music. I wasn't interested in most of it, and I only liked this, you know, certain kinds of rock and roll, but I remembered all of it.
Did you and your father have any music wars, music conflicts? Like a lot of people growing up in the 50s had these big fights in the car, for instance, about who would control the radio. Would you listen to the station that played Papa Loves Mambo and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, or would you listen to the station that was playing Elvis Presley?
No, we didn't really have any fights about that. He was an easygoing guy. He wasn't going to... He didn't think much of that music.
Of which
music? The music that I liked.
Uh-huh.
The music that I liked. He really thought it was really too simple. And from his point of view, he was a well-trained musician. It was very simple, harmonically. What wasn't simple was how to actually do it and make it be good. It's easy to mistake something that's simple for having, you know, little value. Actually, it's pretty hard to be simple and good, as I've found out, you know, many times trying to do something, and why doesn't this song work? It doesn't work. It's no, you know, it should work. It doesn't. It's hard. So we didn't have a disagreement about what to listen to. He didn't think that what I listened to was of any interest at all to him, but he didn't mind. Go and listen to what you want. He just, you know, wanted me to hear the music that he thought was important. But when I didn't have any interest in Mahler or whoever it was that he wanted to play and show me, he just said, fine, doesn't matter. I'm not trying to make a musician out of you anyway.
There are many songs that you've written that everybody knows, that a lot of people know by heart, and could probably, you know, sing Awakened in the Middle of the Night. I'm going to ask you to choose a song that you've written that isn't as well known, but that you like a lot and wish was better well known.
Well, one of the songs that I'm on tour now, and one of the songs that I play is the late great Johnny Ace, and that's not very well known of mine.
Anything you want to say about writing the song? About why you dedicated a song to Johnny Ace?
Well, it's not dedicated to Johnny Ace. The song is about violence and guns. Johnny Ace, that was the first record that I bought. It was called Pledging My Love, and it was written and sung by Johnny Ace, who killed himself playing Russian roulette on New Year's Eve of 1954. And I remember that the disc jockey came on and said that Johnny Ace had killed himself, and said, and so now here's Pledging My Love by the late, great Johnny Ace. And that's how the title came about. But the song talks about that incident that I remembered, and then it jumps ahead 10 years to 1964 and talks about where I was then, which is in England, and mentions that it's a year after JFK. So there's another Johnny Ace who was killed. And then it ends up with somebody telling me, asking me if I heard that John Lennon had been killed. And there's the third Johnny Ace. So the song is really about violence and guns.
Why don't we hear it? And thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
This is Paul Simon.
I was reading a magazine and thinking of a rock and roll song. The year was 1954 and I hadn't been playing that long. When a man came on the radio and this is what he said. He said, I hate to break it to his fans, but Johnny Ace is dead. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I really wasn't such a Johnny Ace fan, but I felt bad all the same. So I sent away for his photograph, and I waited till it came. It came all the way from Texas with a sad and simple face, and they signed it on the bottom from the late great Johnny Ace. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Paul Simon's 1981 song, The Late Great Johnny Ace. His new songs are collected on his new CD, You're the One. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a controversial journal about the Nazification of Europe. This is Fresh Air. When writer Mihail Sebastian's journal was published in Romania a few years ago, it generated heated political controversy over the government's responsibility for war crimes. The diary covered the years between 1935 and 1944. Now it's been published for the first time in English. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Mihail Sebastian was an up-and-coming young playwright and novelist in Bucharest, Romania during the 1930s. A silver-tongued striver, Sebastian moved in tony professional circles. Among his friends were leading intellectuals and politicians, including the playwright Eugene Ionescu and Mircea Eliade, who would later become the renowned historian of religion at the University of Chicago. Sebastian's career was cut short by his death in 1945. As he was hurrying across a busy street in Bucharest, he was hit and killed by a truck. He was 38. But even before his premature death, Sebastian felt his life and opportunities were dwindling down to a vanishing point, because after all, he was a Jew in Nazi-occupied Europe. Only the fact that the Romanian government decided to hedge its bets during World War II and stop deporting its Jewish citizens just in case the Allies won saved Sebastian and roughly half of the Romanian Jewish population from the death camps. Until recently, Sebastian was one of those minor literary figures who rated an entry or two in some other, more prominent writer's biography. But that's all changed with the publication of his voluminous diary, which covers the years 1935 to 1944. Sebastian's journal is a nuanced, gracefully written, and often spellbinding account of the Nazification of Europe, or more precisely, the Nazification of some of the best and brightest minds of the European intelligentsia. Other accounts written by European Jews during that same period have tried to describe the horrors of the Holocaust. Sebastian's journal describes the horrors and consequences of living too comfortably in the rarefied realm of ideas. Unlike Anne Frank, to whose diary Sebastian's journal will inevitably be compared, Sebastian is not an entirely sympathetic figure. For one thing, he seems to have proudly styled himself as a rogue. Many entries here are devoted to his tempestuous and simultaneous affairs with lots of beautiful women. To his obvious amusement, one of Sebastian's lovers tells him, "You are too vile for me not to end up loving you." That's almost a definition of love, Sebastian cattishly comments in his diary. Sebastian is also a whiner, the type of needy narcissist who uses his diary as a pick to probe the recesses of his own navel. Events in the world around him, however, force Sebastian to redirect his gaze outward. That's one reason why his journal is so gripping. Almost day by day, we readers watch as the self-absorbed Sebastian begins to realize that being a Jew may not mean all that much to him, but it's beginning to mean a heck of a lot to most of the Gentiles around him. I wanted to shake Sebastian so many times as I read entries like this one for January 15th, 1937, in which he records a friend's wife shouting, "The Jews are to blame. They take the bread from our mouths. They exploit and smother us. This is our country, not theirs. Romania for the Romanians. Sebastian airily dismisses her diatribe as an attack of anti-Semitism, as though she were suffering from allergies. He and his friends are intellectuals, after all. So Sebastian initially regards their anti-Semitism as almost a passing intellectual phase, just another topic in the free play of ideas that characterizes their conversations in the cafes of Bucharest. Since this is a diary in real time, Sebastian's epiphany about his Jewish identity takes place more gradually and convincingly than any character transformation he might have dramatized in one of his plays. By 1941, when he and other Jews have been deleted from the Writers Association, and he's been called up to serve in a Jewish labor crew, and his former friends have shunned him, and his radio has been confiscated, leaving him feeling as stripped and isolated as Lear, Sebastian bluntly says this about his sanctimonious intellectual pals. The tragedy is that no one has anything to do with it. Everyone disapproves and feels indignant, but at the same time, everyone is a cog in the huge anti-Semitic factory that is the Romanian state. They and tens of thousands like them sign, endorse, and acquiesce, not only tacitly or passively, but through direct participation. The bloodying and mocking of Jews has been public entertainment par excellence. I thought of Sebastian in class the other day when my students were discussing Martin Amis's Time's Arrow, a novel about the Holocaust in which a Nazi doctor is the protagonist. Almost all of my students argued that it was wrong to judge this guy. After all, if any of us were in his place, we probably would have committed the same atrocities. My students' misplaced moral open-mindedness is, I think, a legacy of the last 20 years or so of scholarly theory, deconstruction and its offshoots, which regard critical judgment as naive, suspect, and at worst, elitist. As Mihail Sebastian's journal eloquently testifies, sometimes smart people can be too sophisticated for their own good.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswain. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a scientific explanation of why stress can make you more vulnerable to illness. We talk with Dr. Esther Sternberg, author of The Balance Within. Also, the music of Big Sandy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.